And Bucky, please come entertain us.
Good day. Today, Marsh and I are going to discuss a lady by the name of Angela Murray Gibson, who was a filmmaker out of the filmic world of Castleton, North Dakota, of all places. She ran her own studio out of there in the mid-20s. We're going to do this kind of in two little phases. I'm going to give you a short bio, and then Marsh is going to come on, and we're going to put it in some context, and then we'll wrap up with a couple little sundry items. Finished with a film of hers called The That Ice Ticket, and we'll explain that in a little bit. Okay, Angela Murray Gibson was born in Kirkcaldy or Kilburnie, Scotland, depending on the source, in June of 1879. Her family, her mother, two sisters, a brother, and her father emigrated to the U.S. in 1885. They first settled in Minneapolis, later moving to Fargo, and finally to Castleton, North Dakota, where they settled permanently. She attended North Dakota Agricultural College in the 1890s, which is now North Dakota State University. She graduated in 1898 with a degree in domestic science. She also studied drama and what was called declamation back then in school. She became very interested in performing. And as early as 1902, she shows up and begins to appear at ladies' clubs and church functions, doing dramatic readings and doing some recital work. By 1907, she had expanded her act to utilize a lot of material from her Scottish roots. She added Scottish dances and some Scottish dialects to some recitals she was doing. By the teens, she had pretty much stopped teaching and had settled totally on an entertainment career. While appearing on the East Coast in the early teens, or mid-teens, she was seen by Mary Pickford, who was at that time in production on a film of Pride of the Clan, which has a definite Scottish theme. Actually, the center picture of Pickford, she's wearing one of Gibson's outfits, which was loaned to her by Gibson. Gibson was hired by Pickford to add some realism to the Scottish locales and Scottish clothing and things that were in the film. Gibson became totally enamored with the whole filmmaking process. So she, after the movie was over, she went and found a course that you see up at the top called Photoplay Making at Columbia University, which was taught by pioneering cinematographer Carl Lewis Gregory. And if any of you know me, there's never a time that I don't work Carl Gregory into a presentation. But the scene at the bottom, that's Angela Murray Gibson sitting in front of the camera and Gregory with his hat directing traffic, sort of. So after completion of this course, Gibson did a little work in some regard, which I'm not sure exactly what it was, with some studios on the East Coast trying to break in. She got a little bit of experience, and then she decided she wanted to come back to Castleton and open up her own studio, which would become Gibson Studios. Around 1920, late 20, early 21, it seems that she rapidly began filming. And one of her first films is the infamous That Ice Ticket, which we'll see in a little bit today. The timing of her output was pretty brief, 1921 to 26, but she completed and distributed several one and two reel films. How to Make an Omelet. the Adams' children or the Adams' boys. Aunt Tabitha, which was a story based on a poem by Oliver Wendell Holmes. The Wheat Industry. And there are only two real that's known to exist, Arrested for Life. These frames are actually out of the Library of Congress paper print fragments collection, just as a point of reference. So at the end of the 20s, later 20s, 26, 27, it looks like her filmmaking career pretty much ended as far as her actually producing material. It was announced in a lot of the trades that she had been hired on as a camerawoman for Kinograms. The couple things known that she was to a film was the Killdeer Rodeo in North Dakota and the opening of an old folks' home at Devil's Lake, North Dakota. In the 1930s, she kind of went back to her roots as a teacher. She opened and ran a drama school for children in Castleton. As the 30s went on, she then became involved with the WPA as a teacher and taught various drama, elocution, physical education, pretty much ran the gamut of everything.
Okay, archivists, if you are so inclined to take a picture of this, we are looking for material, and some of this material has a lot of different names that we've seen. So when you get home, if you feel so inclined to peek in your databases and on your shelves, we would appreciate it. Since that we know of, Angela Murray Gibson produced 9 one-half to 2-reel educational films, comedies, and poem-based films, only two of which are extant in their complete form, and we're showing you one of those today. What's interesting about her, one of the many things, is that she usually wrote, produced, edited, starred in, and photographed her own film. So by motion picture studio, I really think we're talking about a woman with a camera and some editing equipment here. Gibson, in effect, had her own motion picture studio, modest though it was. This is a 1924 North Dakota Agricultural College visual instruction catalog, and you can see those films that are available at the time. And this is a 1924 educational screen advertisement for the Gibson Pictures for schools, churches, and clubs. Despite the fact that we are not aware of any films that Gibson produced after 1925, a very zeitgeist 1926 article on women entering male spheres of work calls her, quote, the only woman producer of films in America. And what I have noticed, Bucky and I have been looking into these early women camera operators in particular, they are always the first, the only. So every single time you see a reference to a woman doing this kind of work, they are one of a kind, according to the press. The same year, Film Daily makes much of the fact that she is her own cameraman. Again, this is part of a larger project that Bucky and I are working on, trying to really understand the nature of female camera operators in the 19-teens and 1920s. In what I like to think of as the Bismarck Hollywood slapdown, it's interesting to think about what Gibson did in North Dakota as a combination of local filmmaking, amateur filmmaking, and something I think a little bit more ambitious in scope. And you can see here this June 1926 Bismarck Tribune article has that image of Gibson with the caption describing her as a director cameraman for her own movie company, and it favorably differentiates her productions from Hollywood films. And fortunately, this article also briefly describes her production methodology, about which we know very little. First, she writes a scenario, then she and her mother go over a list of acquaintances and decide on the cast. Miss Gibson operates the camera and does the directing. Since the town's lighting system does not permit Klieg lights, all the shots are taken out of doors. If an interior is to be photographed, the set is made of theater board and set up in the open, and so with amateur actors and actresses and an amateur director, the film is made. And I think that insistence on amateur here is very interesting given the fact that she did indeed have a significant reach in terms of her, at least her distribution ambitions. Film Daily, by the way, ran a version of the same article in July 1926, which indicates to me that this must have been a press release or syndicated story that it was based upon. I don't know how many of you have encountered either material in the paper print collection or films which begin with an image of the cinematographer shooting a film at the beginning of the movie. You see it sometimes in nature and expedition films. But this is the copyright registration card for the wheat industry. And you can see that, interestingly enough, in the description in the copyright collection, photographed in the Red River Valley, picture begins with the photographer starting out to take the scenes. And you could almost like not think about that reading through the copyright collection. But then, luckily, in the paper print collection, we also have these two images of Gibson herself. And so she considered this role, I think, significant enough, being the camera operator, that she included not only those images in the registration, but identified, photographed by Angela Murray Gibson here as the most important role, not directed by, but photographed. And she consistently emphasized this role in the productions that she made above all others. And, of course, the idea of a director in the 1920s would have been a very standard idea at the time. But I think it's interesting that she returned to this conceptualization. This is from Aunt Tabitha. And I show you this just to note the official use of that Gibson Studios letterhead. This is from the Library of Congress copyright collection from late 1921 concerning another lost, hopefully temporarily, film. So there is ample evidence to support the idea that a female camera operator was a novelty. This advertisement, of course, tells you that you can find your man here and you can send your problems to our cameraman's question box. And as we've been looking into more and more of these women camera operators in the teens and 20s. These are just some examples from even as late as 1937, the only professional camera woman in Hollywood, only first. You see that over and over again. So it's very interesting to think about how to do a kind of history of both the kind of amnesia that happens on a daily basis in the trades and then also of this particular role. So, to the film at hand that we will be watching in a moment. That Ice Ticket had its premiere in early 1921 at the Portland Theater in Castleton, North Dakota. Later that year, it was screened at the opening of the 1,400-seat State Theater in Castleton, and Gibson made personal appearances at two of those showings. I think it's noteworthy that the local press bothered to report, surely drawing from things that Gibson was promoting, that she used a French camera with a German lens on American film. It's very international for North Dakota. Given the thematic of orphans this year, not only is this likely Gibson's first film, but it is also a romantic comedy, and as a bonus, it is a smallpox-themed romantic comedy. As I watched and rewatched this film, one of the things that really struck me is how short the shots are in this film. There are a lot of 1 to 2 second shots that's just the vocabulary she uses in this film, and I think it's very different from other films from this time period, so just kind of look out for that. It also stars Gibson in the leading role as Madge, and so my final thing that I want you to just kind of think about, and that Bucky and I have been talking about, is, well, who's running the camera if she's the photographer and she's in much of the film? And I believe the answer's got to be her mom, because that seems to be the studio. So we don't have any evidence of this yet, but that is likely the case.
So a few words about the film provenance. By the way, I forgot to mention that Gibson became quite ill in the late 40s. It was thought she had tuberculosis. Her sister, Ruby, who financed through her sister Ruby, owned what was called the Beehive Store in Castleton, which was catered to women's novelties, women's clothing, and things of that nature. She did quite well during that period, so it seems that she was the one who financed most of Angela Murray Gibson's work. In the late 40s, after she became ill, her sister placed her in different sanatoriums and hospitals for treatment. She died in 1953, and it turned out that she had had lung cancer. The film provenance comes in as I've been researching this, trying to track the material. The most likely scenario that I've heard is a man by the name of Alfred G. Arvold, who founded the Little Country Theater at North Dakota State University, was given the films by Gibson sometime in the 30s. They were stored at the university in the North Dakota State Library for several years. Eventually, there was the Cass County Museum, which has one of my favorite names in the world, Bonanzaville. In 1954, Bonanzaville was formed, and although it didn't have a building yet, so the material stayed at North Dakota State Library. In 1972, the Bonanzaville building was completed, and it seems that sometime within a year or so of that, the materials eventually made their way to Bonanzaville. In 1975, as happens in that area, there was a devastating flood. This material was part of that flood. Now, I've been through the archival records at Bonanzaville and from North Dakota State University. There's no official list of titles that she ever left there, so there's not a real way of knowing of how much material was there. However, in 75, after the flood, they had an insurance assessment. The local Bicentennial Commission contacted a man by the name of Bill Snyder, bottom left, who ran a pre- and post-production facility in Fargo, North Dakota. They told him, you know, we have a little bit of funding money left over. If you want to take a look at these films and see if you can do anything with them, you know, we'll pay a little bit of money. So he took the films. Again, we don't know which ones, how many he took, but he was able to preserve/copy two of them in their entirety. One is the Two Reel film Arrested for Life. The other one he did in entirety is That Ice Ticket, which we'll see in a bit. And there's a film that you see in the bottom right called The Adams' Boys. And there's one reel of two that's left in there. So in the late 90s, a person that was a filmmaker that was working for Bill Snyder by the name of Mike Schultz came, he told me on a very slow day, he started poking through material that was there and found some of the Gibson material. He did a small mini documentary that played at Fargo Film Festival called The Angela Murray Experience. When I saw that, it took me a little bit of time to track it down. We finally found the copy and got a digital copy. I looked at it, and there were scenes in there from some of her films that weren't supposed to exist. So I did some more poking around, and in Bill Snyder's collection, there was a set of outtakes. And in a couple of those outtakes, I found a couple little fragments of Gibson material. This is something that we found in there. It opens with a Western scene, and we'll run it for a second. It runs about 20 seconds, but I'll try to stop it at just the right spot so you can see something that kind of made, if I had hair on my head, it would have stood up, but I guess we'll just go with my ears.
Yeah, I got it. How do I start it? Hit play. There you go. Yeah.
So we start with this. We start with this little Western scene.
Well, I tried to stop it. Let's see if we can get back there.
So as you see, we start with this little Western. It moves to the jailer's office. And as you, whoop.
Can you get me back there?
Yes, I'm technically inept.
Okay, I'll stop it right there.
No problem.
Yeah, Okay, as you can see in the background, there's a 35 millimeter camera and what we believe to be Gibson directing a scene. Got no clue what this is from. It's not identified in any way, shape, or form. It was just part of the same reel of outtakes from all our other material. So, hey, anybody recognize anybody? No. But again, it's another case of her. She filmed herself into pretty much everything, and you know, this follows along with that. So it was a, even though it's a very short piece, it was a nice surprise. That versus the, so the movie we're going to show, That Ice Ticket, if you look at all the trade magazines, it's listed as The Ice Ticket. Everywhere I found, I think I've only ever seen one reference to That Ice Ticket. However, if you look at the top left, the title card clearly says That Ice Ticket. I started digging around to try to find out what's real. I don't. So what we did was, on all of Gibson's other films, except I think That Ice Ticket, Bill Snyder had a man come in and they redid all the titles. If you look at the title on the right, that's the title card remade by Snyder Films. The title card from The Ice Ticket's on the left. And at the bottom, I just frame grabbed the Gibson Studios and tried to see if I could line up which one was which. And so we have The Ice Ticket title on the right, Snyder title in the middle, original Gibson title on the left. So I'm going to put it to you guys. What do you think? Is it that or the? And my thought of that, and Marsh and I both looked at, when we looked at the film, when this film fades in and fades out, that title, it's not real clear, it's not real clean, and I think his text and his, he would have changed that title. So I still believe it's That Ice Ticket. Our only explanation is somehow it got out in the trades the first time as The Ice Ticket. Got known that way, and I think she just sort of ran with it. So, okay. Well, now it's time to run the film. Thank the Lord, Stephen Horn is playing for it because the soundtrack is horrendous. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
I also wanted to mention thanks go to Women's Film Preservation Fund and Kino Lorber for providing the preservation money to preserve the extant Gibson films, and Color Lab for doing the preservation work. And this should be, and it's expected to be out in later this year, in a DVD set being released by Kino Lorber. So thanks to all of them.
I told Stephen Horning to go because he has to play for another whole show tonight. So thank you, Stephen, for doing the marathon with us. So from camera woman to someone who has got the nickname Tito's cameraman. How's it looking? Optimistic? Let's come up and switch computers then. And while Adam plugs you in, I'll let you greet the crowd. Documentary filmmaker who won the Toronto International Film Festival Prize for Best Documentary, and now she's going to show us her new documentary. But this year's film, The Other Side of Everything, will be playing at the museum tomorrow afternoon at what time?
Sunday at 4.
Sunday at 4 o'clock, I said tomorrow. Sunday at 4 o'clock in this theater. Mila.
Hi, everyone. So the presentation that I'm about to do is about a man called Stevan Lobudovic, who was a cameraman of the Yugoslav newsreels and played an extraordinary role in the way the Yugoslav newsreels reached out to what was the non-aligned world in the 1960s and 70s. And as I was born in Belgrade, Yugoslavia at the time, and since Yugoslavia doesn't exist, for the last 20 years, I thought I'd open just with a small historical note, which is that Yugoslavia occupied a very unique position at the time of its kind of socialist episode, which is that it, Yugoslav President Tito, who ruled the country from 1945 to his death in 1980, had implemented a kind of unique version of socialism in or communism in Yugoslavia at the time. Because in 1948, he broke with Stalin and got Yugoslavia expelled from the Soviet bloc. So the country kind of found itself adrift between two blocs in the Cold War. And Tito's solution for that was that he headed out in a series of what were called voyages of peace, which is that he sailed by ship starting in 1954 all the way to India, Indonesia, Burma, Ceylon, Ethiopia, the west coast of Africa, trying to find new allies and friends for Yugoslavia. And that's really where this story begins. And just to give you an additional context, which I think is really important, at the time, Tito was not perceived the way that he's generally perceived today, which is as a communist dictator. At the time, the world saw him as the man who had led a resistance movement against the German occupation of Yugoslavia in the Second World War. And he had the kind of cachet of being the only leader of the Allied forces in the Second World War who was wounded in battle. That's a photo of Tito in 1943 after he was wounded in a German offensive. And I think this is really important in order to try and situate how at the time the countries of Africa and Asia who were gaining their independence from colonial powers saw him and greeted him during his voyages. So this story begins in 1959. So at the time, Tito has already traveled to a number of countries in Africa and Asia, seeking to create new political alliances with them. And in 1959, a delegation from Algeria came to visit him in Yugoslavia. Algeria at that point had been at war with France for 4 years, and they had just created an Algerian provisional government, and their diplomatic mission was to try and get that government recognized by somebody. And Yugoslavia became the first European power to recognize the independence of the Algerian government. And in this really striking photo, you see Tito giving a rifle to the president of the Algerian Provisional Government, a man called Ferhat Abbas. And the Algerian newspaper of record at the time, or the newspaper of the Liberation Front of Algeria, was called El Mujahid, the fighter. And they carried on their front page, it was a newspaper that came out once a week, twice a month, depending on how they were able to publish it. They led with that story on their front page, the fact that the Algerian delegation had traveled to Yugoslavia, that Tito had recognized them. And what I find really interesting is that, so you see on the top, it's the official organ of the National Liberation Front of Algeria. They devoted most of that edition to everything that had happened in Yugoslavia during the visit. But what's really striking is this little paragraph down here where it says, President Tito gives to President Ferhat Abbas a war rifle, symbol of the resistance against foreign oppression. So he's kind of, in effect, handing over the tradition of his resistance to the Algerians, kind of trying to symbolically side with them in their resistance against oppression. And then, interestingly enough, it goes on to say that the delegation then went to the Secretariat of Information, where films about the Liberation War were offered as gifts to be shown to the Algerian fighters. And this is where cinema kind of enters this story, because the Algerians felt that they didn't have enough knowledge, tactical and strategic knowledge, to fight a war against the French, and they had asked the Yugoslav to provide them with fiction films and documentaries about the National Liberation War in Yugoslavia and the Second World War in order to get some kind of tactical or strategic ideas from the films. But what makes this episode really extraordinary isn't just the exchange of a rifle, and you might find the gifting of a rifle a strange way to address this year's theme of orphans. But Dan and I agreed that we can extend the concept of love to the idea of transnational solidarity, which is what we're trying to do here. But what marks this episode is that Tito had said to them during their visit, and there's a transcript of their meeting, that Yugoslavia will support them by giving them weapons, by giving them uniforms, but what they are missing are images of their struggle, because the world was seeing the French version of what was happening in the colony. The French were calling them terrorists and outlaws. The France didn't recognize that they were at war with Algeria until October 1999, so 40 years later. And Tito's whole argument was that what the FLN, the Liberation Front, needed was images in order to tell the world their story. And he said that he had a solution for them, which is that he was going to send them a cameraman. And so enter the Yugoslav Newsreels. The Yugoslav Newsreels was the state newsreel agency. It was the first film studio created in communist or socialist Yugoslavia. Actually, it was the film unit of the headquarters during the war. And it was a unique film studio in all of Yugoslavia because it answered directly to the executive branch of the federal government. So they were directly under political control. They produced, obviously, weekly newsreels, as most newsreels did, and special thematic issues, as well as documentary films. But what is interesting to note is that in 1957, they joined the International Association of Newsreels. And by 1959, they were exchanging newsreels with more than 23 countries. So they were really at the heart of the distribution of information throughout the countries that they had partnered with. And most of these countries were either in Africa, Asia, or Latin America. Now, the newsreels had been charged with filming all of Tito's travels. As I told you in the beginning, he took these voyages of peace. And they had assigned two cameramen to follow Tito on these trips. These were Stevan Lobodovic and Dragan Mitrovic. Here seen in the pyramids in Egypt during Tito's first trip there. And what is striking about this tandem is that they were two of the best cameramen in Yugoslavia at the time. That's how they came to work for the newsreels, and they came to be assigned to follow Tito. But both of them were kind of the type of personality that really suited the job they were given. And one thing that Stevan always emphasized whenever I talked to him was that if you think that being the president's cameraman is a cushy job because you can access things that other cameramen can't access, it was not at all easy because all of the protocol was determined by state security services. And the photo I really like on the left down there is Stevan trying to breach a line in Bizerta during the French bombardment of the town because he was trying to get images of what the French were doing there. So it was always this kind of struggle to get access, and the two of them worked out various ways of distracting. One of them would distract the intelligence people in order for the other to slip in and to film something. That's Stevan on the deck of Tito's ship when they were traveling to Burma, and basically the two of them filming President Tito. So the two of them had just completed a 97-day trip with Tito, where Tito had visited Egypt, Indonesia, Burma, India, Sri Lanka, Ethiopia, Sudan, Syria, and Greece in one journey. And it was kind of unusual for a head of state to be absent from his own country for more than 3 months, but it says something about the importance that Tito placed on making ties with these countries. And it was Stefan Labudovich who would be given the task of going to Algeria to film for the FLN. And what I find really beautiful is I worked with Stefan for over 3 years, but he never told me that he had actually kept diaries during that time, and I only found it out very, very recently. So in a page from his diary from 1959, on September 25th, he made this entry. He wrote, "Filmed U.S. Minister of Agriculture visiting Tito, found out about my new mission, and thinking about it all." And that's actually the day that he was told that he was going to go and join the FLN in Algeria. Why did they choose him and not Dragan Mitrovic? My theory is that, so at the time, Stefan was 31 years old. But my theory is that Stefan had been in the Partisans in the Second World War. That's him in 16. And in the Partisans, his job had been to photograph the activities of the Partisans and to make wall information bulletins and inform the troops of what was going on. And one really interesting thing that also maybe helps you read the Stefan's films, and we're going to see one in a second, is that he was drafted when the Red Army liberated Belgrade and the Soviets arrived. They saw his information bulletins and they asked who was the man doing them. And they showed this 16-year-old boy and they said he's the one doing them. And so the Russians said, as they do in Russian, "Davai," which means give him. And they took him. And they conscripted him inside the Red Army, and he became a propagandist for the Red Army. And he found the Red Army propaganda so one-dimensional and didactic that he decided to desert, which is what he did. He escaped from the Red Army, and he went back to the Partisans. Many years later, in 1957, when Tito traveled for the first time to the Soviet Union after repairing the breach with the Soviets, Stefan was filming a press conference given by Mikoyan, the head of the Soviet Communist Party. And in front of everybody, the Mikoyan said, "Is there a man here called Stefan Labudovich?" And his colleagues pointed at him, and Mikoyan looked at him and said, "Deserter." So 17 years later, they knew that he had abandoned them during the war. But it's very interesting because it speaks to Stefan's ideas of propaganda, which were not necessarily one-dimensional nor simplistic, and they kind of go at the heart of the films that he was making in Algeria. And so just to situate what he was doing in Algeria in a wider movement at the time, which was this idea of cinematographic third worldism, there was an idea between newly independent countries in Africa, Asia, and Latin America that there was a solidarity to be built between them in the transfer of knowledge concerning cinema and how to use cinema for propaganda. So I absolutely have to underline here that Stefan was at heart a propagandist. When we say newsreels, we're not talking about information, we're really talking about the mounting of an argument, which is this whole idea of participative sympathy. He was really there to make the case for the Algerian side. Why is this so important to the story? Well, because the crux of winning the war was actually winning the battle of information. And there's a wonderful book written by Matthew Connolly, which is titled A Diplomatic Revolution, Algeria's Fight for Independence. And he writes in his book that the war was not primarily won or lost on the ground, but through political maneuvering. Militarily, the French effectively reduced the FLN's guerrilla force. Politically, the French lost the war because they failed to recognize that the battle they needed to win was that of ideas. The FLN, cognizant of its weaknesses in the face of overwhelming French military power, restructured the geometry of the conflict around international opinion. And this is where Stefan was playing a role, because he was making films in order to try and influence international opinion. And now let's take a little look at what he was filming in the field. I'm going to show you the first materials that he sent back to Belgrade from the field. And then later on, I'm going to show you a 20-minute film. And I subtitled this, but then the film you'll be watching it's the English version of the film. Desetari i vodnici podigli su svoje jedinice. Alarm. Pripreme su munjevito izvršene. Četa ne smije biti iznenađena. I pre nego što je neprijatelj osjetio da se približio Četa, jedinica Alžirske nacionalno oslobodilačke vojske je spremna da dejstvuje. What's really kind of striking to me when you look at what he was doing is, one, he was really making cinema. It's visible in the framing, it's visible in the way that he's trying to tell the story. But also, he had a very, very clear idea of what he was there to accomplish. And the first thing that he was doing, the films were really aimed at two audiences. One was mobilizing popular support on the ground for the FLN. So these films were shown within the country with mobile cinema units that would travel around the various battalions, and they would also be shown in the camps where the Algerian civilian population had been moved by the French. And then the second thing that he was trying to do with the films was to get them out there internationally. And it's really interesting because when I started going through Cuban newsreels from 1960, 1961, and East German newsreels, I found stories there which are from a correspondent in Yugoslavia, from a cameraman from Yugoslavia. Here is images of what is happening in Algeria. Stevan kept, as I said, a diary throughout this whole period. And when you read his diary entries, it's really interesting to match what's in the images with his thoughts on what he's doing. And just so I just chose a little excerpt, which is, he's commenting on the footage that he's making. He's also embedded in the units. Stevan was sent there to spend 3 months making a film. When he arrived and he put on the uniform of the FLN, he said that he didn't feel he could leave them until victory was won, until the country had achieved independence. He ended up spending 3 years in Algeria. What is really extraordinary about the role he performed in the Algerian War is that this was a diplomatic mission, so he would be filming his news. Reels came from Italy. He would film on the border between Tunisia and Algeria. The material would then be sent via diplomatic mail by the Yugoslav embassy in Tunisia to Belgrade, and it would all be developed in Belgrade. And as a result, all of that material and its 83 kilometers of footage, 35 millimeter film, is still preserved in Belgrade today. It's never been given to the Algerians, and that's part of the story that I'll get back to towards the end of the presentation. What is interesting, again, is that because he was stationed with the military headquarters, he formed a close relationship with the military commanders, two of whom would end up being presidents of Algeria. And that opened a direct diplomatic channel between President Tito and future Algerian presidents, and they recognized the roles, because he's not the only Yugoslav cameraman who did these kinds of things. The cameraman had played in establishing really close political links with other countries. And one final aspect of his work was, it was very quickly decided that it's not enough for him to shoot, he needs to start training Algerian cameramen to produce their own newsreels. So he set up a training school in Gardimao. Gardimao is a Tunisian town on the border between Tunisia and Algeria, where the Algerian military headquarters was. He set up a training school where he started a 3-month course of teaching Algerian cameramen. The Yugoslav newsreels supplied the Gardimao headquarters with a film laboratory and cameras, and as a result, the footage that was shot there, again, was sent to Belgrade, and it was edited in Belgrade, and the first 5 editions of the Algerian newsreels were thus produced during the period of the war. And in terms of international reach, as I mentioned, this material was not only developed in Belgrade, but it was edited in Belgrade. And that raises a really interesting question of authorship, because Stevan wasn't there when the newsreels were edited. He was on the ground in Tunisia. And there's a whole question of who wrote the voiceovers and kind of shaped the political argument that these films were making. And again, you'll see that very clearly in the film that I will show you. What I find really interesting is to see the close links. For example, this is a telegram sent by the State Secretariat for Foreign Affairs, which is essentially the Yugoslav Ministry of Foreign Affairs, to the Yugoslav Embassy in Tunisia, saying, Tula Budović Rashid arrived and began work. Rashid Aytidir was one of the commanders, the military commanders of the FLN. And you see that he came directly to Belgrade in order to work on the material that Stevan had shot. Old material is good. We'll inform about new one developed. Opinion here is it would be good for Boumendjel or one of the leaders to come to redact the film. Boumendjel was the Minister of Information in the Algerian Provisional Government. So you see the extent to which the film was being shaped by politicians. One other thing that I found really funny is these are the diaries of President Tito's projectionist. And one thing that I find really striking, Tito watched films almost on a daily basis. There are years when he watched 365 films in a single year. And his projectionist kept really detailed records of the fiction film Tito would watch, but then also right before the screening of the fiction film, he would watch a newsreel. And so on the day that Tito watched The Revolt of the Gladiators, which is an Italian film in 1959, is the day that he would have watched the newsreel that you just saw, which was Stevan's report from the field in Algeria. So kind of keeping a really close eye on what was being produced by the newsreels. And then we get to the summer of 1960, and the idea was the Algerians created Service Cinema, so their first cinema unit within the provisional government. And the whole idea was that it was August and September would be the United Nations General Assembly, and they decided that was the moment to make a film and show the film to the UN and try and sway international opinion. And so Stefan was recalled from Algeria, and he traveled to the United Nations to accompany President Tito there and make a film about Tito's appearance at the UN, and he took this material with him. And the film was shown. So 1960 was kind of a spectacular year at the UN. It was the year that Castro came to New York and threatened to sleep in Central Park because he threw him out of a hotel. It was the year that Khrushchev banged his shoe when addressing the General Assembly. So it was kind of the year when they all came together in New York. And during the United Nations General Assembly, this film that I'm going to show you called Our Algeria was screened. And several weeks later, the United Nations adopted a declaration on the granting of independence to colonial countries and peoples. And so I'm not arguing that the film is the reason this happened, but it definitely came out at the moment where they were absolutely in a position that they could influence international opinion. So let's watch this film, which is about 20 minutes long, and then I'll just give you the sequel to what happened later with Stefan.
Algeria has been at war. These men are not professional soldiers. They hate war, war which brings suffering to their families. They are forced to fight, so that Algeria may once more be theirs. To them, Algeria means land. Colonists from France, Italy, and Spain settled on over 3 million hectares of the best land. The land also is rich in minerals and oil. Others came to exploit them. The Algerians, pushed back to the mountains and arid plains, became foreigners in their own land. Cooperatives were run for colonists alone. The Algerians were forced to cultivate barren soil or to sell their manual labor to the foreigner. With their enormous profits, colonists were able to impose their laws in Algiers, as they did in Paris, to hold up reforms and fake elections. The happiness of the few depended on the unhappiness of the many. Around the luxurious buildings and labor exchanges hung landless peasants driven into the cities by poverty to find only unemployment and misery, anger and mistrust. Algerians first tried to win their right to live by peaceful means. At meeting after meeting, the men and women were prepared for political action. Banned papers kept reappearing. Manifestation followed manifestation. Reprisals were ruthless. Resolutions, demands, speeches, all came up against this wall. Barbaros, the old prison of Algiers. Peaceful means proved useless. Other means had to be found. The struggle of arms began on the 1st of November, 1954. peasants, the workers, the unemployed, the students, formed a people's army. An army which gave new hope to a people suffering from indignity. For 6 years, France has turned her might against these people. Her police, her air force, half of her army, and more than half of her navy are engaged in the Algerian war with the armed assistance of NATO. A million and a half of French youth, at one time or another, fought this war to no purpose. France is at present spending over 2 billion francs a day to carry on this war. For 6 years in the gorges of Aurès, on the cliffs of Cabilia, from the mountain regions of Kor to the hills of Tlemcen, whether there is Sirocco or snow, the people march across their land. The country has awakened to the march of free men. A French patrol is signaled. An ambush is prepared. Soldiers try to take cover, but they are surrounded. Carried out on the electric installations and railway lines used by the enemy, the destruction of military material and equipment. This is part of their daily work. Ever since 1958, the French army has been launching big offensives in all parts of Algeria. In Kabylia, in Ouarzazate, in Algerois, in the mountain areas of Odna and those of Aurès, as well as in North Constantinople, Zakarian Atlas, and in East Constantinople. Each time, the National Liberation Army attacks, reforms, and attacks again. Each month brings fresh reinforcements. Modern arms take the place of the old ones. The French forces are kept at bay. Under air cover, an armored train carrying iron ore from the mines of Wenza approaches. plane setting fire to the forests. A plane sells death with napalm. A plane forces terror-stricken women and children to run so as to escape burial under the ruins of their villages. Shanties will be in ruins, but no force can destroy their newly won dignity and self-respect. It is not always possible to stay, because everything is in ruins. After having salvaged a few precious things from the ruins, they take the road, the long road of peasants fleeing from devastation and forbidden zones to go to the big cities. There they are forced into shanty towns, where already 700,000 peasants over the last 6 years have hidden their misery and their hunger. Entire villages take the paths which lead to the frontiers of Morocco and Tunisia. Summer and winter, the refugees live in tents or in huts. They eat grass from the fields, or wheat provided by international aid. At least they are free from fear. This is Algeria today. Almost half of its people dead, imprisoned, uprooted, or in arms. Army has rounded up 2 million old men, women and children, living in terror, uncared for and abandoned. And yet the country survives. Soldiers, peasants, citizens, refugees, those in camps help one another. They share the same sufferings, the same hope, the same objective. National Liberation Liberation Army distributes wheat among the peasant refugees. In other parts of the country, the peasants provide food and soldiers for the army. Political commissars and officials go about explaining what the common struggle means, the common struggle in which everyone, civilian or soldier, in rags or in jalaba, calls each other brother. The war goes on. The people must learn to use modern arms and complicated equipment. The people must turn themselves into a modern and efficient army. Suffering, life must go on. In the Algerian mountains as well as abroad, efforts are made to curb the National Liberation Army to feed and clothe the children. Children who dream of rebuilding their homes destroyed by French planes. People kept for more than a century in ignorance and illiteracy is hungry for education, culture, and technology. Young and old, children and veterans, learn to read and write. Algeria is training her people and technicians for tomorrow. Since 1958, the Algerian people have had a responsible government, ready for peace or war. In June 1960, the Algerian and French representatives met for the first time at Milan. The Algerians were acclaimed as messengers of peace by the people of Algeria, by the people of France, and by people throughout the world. But the Milan Conference was torpedoed. France wished to dictate her own terms. Talks between the Algerians and the French became impossible. Despite the realistic and reasonable attitude of the Provisional Government of the Republic of Algeria, despite the solemn guarantees pledged to the minorities, the French government still insists on a senseless reconquest of the country. But the Algerian people's determination to be free cannot be destroyed by planes or machine guns. The voice of the Algerian people is now powerful. The peoples of Asia, Africa, and Latin America answer their calls. Each year, for 5 years, the Algerian problem has been raised in the United Nations. In the last 5 years, the world has changed. Africa has changed. The great powers of the old nations must choose between outdated colonialism or friendship with the young nations. So long as the nations of the world do not insist on peace and fail to impose a just solution on the only war being fought in the world today, the Algerians will continue to fight for the right to exist. Like all nations of the world, the people of Algeria have the right to freedom and independence. Mm-hmm. nations of the world. The people of Algeria have the right to peace.
So what I find striking about this is that you see the construction of a counter-propaganda narrative. And what a lot of the work I did with Stefan in the 3 years that I filmed with him is to try and determine how much fabrication went on behind these images, and there was a lot. So obviously his priority was to try and show that there was a war going on, because if you watch French newsreels of the time, there's absolutely no mention of the fact that there's a war in Algeria. They focus on French soldiers in Algerian schools. They never show combat. But what is interesting is that Stefan, in his diaries, but also in the interviews I did with him, a lot is revealed. For example, he constructed a military unit with soldiers wearing the same uniforms because he wanted to present them as an army rather than a ragtag band of fighters. And then another thing that was really interesting is, because France broke off diplomatic relations with Yugoslavia, they could no longer get access to highly sensitive film stock, and Ilford, the British company, refused to sell it to them for the same reason. So he couldn't film anything that was happening during the night, except all of the guerrilla raids on French positions took place during the night. So they started staging raids during the day for the purpose of his filming. And then when you start to tease out the amount of construction that's going on behind these images, you really get an interesting sense of how this information war became a model for all information wars that followed, because the Algerian War, the 7 years of the Algerian War, really became the apex of anti-colonial struggle around the world, essentially. And so it also leads to an interesting reckoning today, because I traveled with Stefan to Algeria, and he's a hero in Algeria. His camera is displayed in the military museum, and he's treated with the highest honors, and the current president of Algeria, Abdelaziz Bouteflika, is a friend of his. But there's a real reckoning to be had about the revolution that they were fighting for and the country that they succeeded in creating or didn't succeed in creating. And then the story continues, essentially. So the model that was set for the Yugoslav newsreel's role that they played in the Algerian struggle was then, oddly enough, replicated in many other countries. So the Yugoslav newsreels established a collaboration with Mali when it obtained its independence, and they filmed 171 newsreels of the Republic of Mali, as well as documentary film and two feature-length fiction films in Bambara and in French. And this is something Stefan was involved with as well. It was a collaboration that lasted for more than two decades. After that, they established a collaboration with Tanzania, and 29 issues of the first newsreels of independent Tanzania were filmed by the Yugoslav cameraman in Swahili and in English. One especially came to prominence, who was a colleague of Stefan's, who was Dragutin Popovic, who became friends with Samora Machel and ended up making the first ever film about Frelimo and the independence struggle of Mozambique in 1966. And the entire collection of the Mozambique and Frelimo films are also held in the newsreels in Belgrade. They made a film in Palestine, so Stefan was sent to Palestine in 1971 to make a film with Yasser Arafat, which is called Blood and Tears. And so all of this to say that there is an incredible body of archive held in the vaults of the newsreels in Belgrade that have not been accessed for a very long time by anybody and have not been seen publicly for decades, because there's a really intense battle for the repatriation of this material going on between the Serbian government and the governance of Mali, Algeria, Tanzania, Guinea-Bissau, Chad, and Mozambique. Because it's really interesting when you look at the original contracts that were drawn up at the time, the question of archiving them and accessing them at a later date was never really addressed. And so there's the Malian government has been the most intense, I would say, or active at trying to get access to these materials. The situation that the Serbian government finds itself is very bizarre. If they want to make duplicate negatives of this material, they would have to take it out of the country to Bologna, which is against Serbian law. And so the film material is basically stuck in Belgrade for the time being, is not being properly looked after, and is deteriorating. And I just want to finish with personal note, I guess. So for the last 3 years, I've been working on this film about Stefan, and I want you to meet him through this trailer that I made for the film that we're about to start editing now. It's a very short thing, it's 3 minutes long.
When they poured across the border, I was cautioned to surrender. This I could not do.
Генералы Стефан Лавович, родин дяду Тарасу 27. Занимание – финский сниматель. Церковь, суды финские новости, смерть фашизму, свобода народу, удры. Крымцам рад на сниму. Я бруем Алжир, Палестину, Мозамбик, Анголу. Прежде смо границу, то тебе се сумнило. Мы не летим на никому засу. То с Рафи Мали.
То с Рафи Мали.
Нико, я би се поел жив, jer ja sam insistirao na tu akciju. Počeo se malo rasvešćuje. Sve susrete nesvešćeni sam snimao da je ta ideja veličanstvena. Zaista u tom periodu su bile velike ličnosti svetskog klasa. Fidel Castro, car Haile Selassie, tražio da mu budem kamerman. Prvo sam filmao lošu minu i ekipi sa Jasera Malekvata. Kad stavim 50-icu na oku, tačno vidim koga imam ispred sebe, kakav je čovjek. Nehru nije podnosio komunizam. Što se tiče Nasera, ovaj se ponoša kao da mu je otac. Sukar, simpatičan, bio igrač. Kako već je skoncentrirao, on je tu. Jedino gde sam omanuo kod Idi Amina. Kako sam tako mogao da omanim o tom čoveku da pravim film? Dan danas ne mogu sebi da oprosim. Šta je sve učinjeno da bi se došlo do te slova? Kako su sve žrtve pale? Eto, zato. Istorija o filmskoj traci. Šta dalje?
So Stefan sadly left us 4 months ago, but the film will exist, at least to tell the story. Thank you.